Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller. During the week of June 10th through the 15th, the University of Alaska Fairbanks was host to the first annual Midnight Sun Writers Conference. Invited to be part of the professional staff, to read from his works and to teach, was Native American writer Gary Hobson. Hobson is part Chickasaw and part Cherokee from the border country between Arkansas and Oklahoma. He currently teaches in the Native Studies program at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. He has published numerous poems and edited an anthology of contemporary Native American literature called The Remembered Earth. Hobson was asked to the Writers' Conference in Fairbanks primarily because he is a Native American, and I asked him how he feels about always having that label attached to his name.
It's kind of ambiguous. It's a two-sided thing. I think in a sense it's a label I'm very proud of, but at the same time it's kind of a limiting one. In other words, they will introduce you as the Native American writer or something like that. And I have a lot of things that I've written that really don't deal with Native American issues. I've translated French, as a matter of fact. And I've written stories about Southeast Asia, which most of my characters might not be Native American. I feel that I am a Native American writer, but I'm other things too, you know. So in a sense, it can be confining, but at the same time, it can be a very prideful kind of thing. A lot of it depends on my mood at the time, I guess, depending on what kind of relations I've had with publishers. Or
or what tone, perhaps, they
right,
say it
yeah,
in.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I'm fairly comfortable with it overall.
Mm-hmm. It's one that I'm thinking of the situation here where I think writers and anybody that comes into some kind of public light that's an Alaska native, mm-hmm. that they certainly have pride in being Alaska native, mm-hmm. but the being singled out mm-hmm. for recognition just because you are a native writer sort of sometimes implies that's why, and not that your work isn't
yes,
good.
Yes, right. Uh-huh. That has been done sometimes. But I think that, the writer ought to go ahead and, accept that, but transcend it, Go on and say, and surprise people. They expect you to maybe come up with maybe a tribal chant reworked in English, but show them that you know something about Star Trek. Maybe you know something about astronomy, and the capital of Japan, or in other words, we're also citizens of the world, and mm-hmm. and show go beyond that, and that's what I attempt to do in my work too.
And that shows up in the anthology, I would guess.
Yeah, to a great extent. There's very traditional people in it, but there are also people who have very nebulous ties to it, and a lot of the poems in there are stories. Sometimes, they won't even seem Indian. It merely might be because of the person's background, racial background, cultural background. But others are set maybe definitely on the reservation or something like that. But by and large, most of the things in the anthology are all 20th century things. Poems about people in the 20th century or stories about 20th century life. It doesn't go back to the old days. I've tried to get away from that always. It's like the TV commercials. You see them, the Mazola margarine maiden, as I call her,
mm-hmm.
You call it corn, we call it maize, that kind of thing, of thinking Indians always have to dress 19th century way. And saying that we are, part of this century too. And so in this anthology, I tried to have that there too, to show that, people are concerned about this, this time as much as anyone else is.
But can you take that... Mm-hmm. that tradition out of the writer that
mm-hmm.
that is got a steeped in a Native mm-hmm. background. Yeah. Can you take that out?
No, but because you happen to look to things in the modern day, it does not negate that. It's always there. And I think what makes richness is how you use those old things, you know, in a modern dress. For instance, we grew up hearing stories maybe about coyote, or maybe, you know, the the raven, or maybe in my home, actually, or my home country, you know, about the rabbit, you know, like the old Br'er Rabbit stories or old Indian stories, you know. Well, we can take the rabbit character or the coyote character or raven character and bring him into the 20th century. Tell about what he does when he walks down the streets of Fairbanks or streets of Phoenix or something like that. You know, that, you know, he's still there in modern dress.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
That reminds me of a piece in the book that was talked about that seemed to combine both as mm-hmm. almost this illustration about the deer hunter. It's old, mm-hmm. old and new.
Oh, that's my poem. Yeah, deer hunting. It's called. Yeah,
deer hunting.
Yeah. Okay. The first part is really, it's the way the country club type people hunt deer in my part of the country, and you know, in other words, a sport. You know, and then I have the second part, in which it deals with the traditional Indian way of hunting deer, at least Cherokee way of hunting deer, and the way that you know, the things that are involved, asking permission of the deer and, you know, and killing the deer and the initiation for the young boy when he kills his first deer, and the way it becomes a thing of returning, trying to return what you can back to the, you know, back to the woods, you know, after you've killed the deer. And if we have things, if you don't do that, you do these things, they may, you know, you can have dire consequences. For instance, we say that when somebody has rheumatism at home, it's because they have been remiss in their way of killing deer, you know, or they've been disrespectful to deer in their life, you know, and it causes them no longer to have that fast, you know, rapid way of moving. You know, they're not agile anymore, and the deer got back to them. The dead deer got back to them by giving them rheumatism. Mm-hmm. And so the poem tries to deal with those two things, you know, like a modern way, a non-Indian way, which is part of our world too, way of looking at killing deer. And then the other way, the Indian way of killing deer. I compare and contrast those two viewpoints in that poem.
Do you think somebody that was reading that poem, it's a modern poem,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't really have the telltale traces that you would mm-hmm. you would label Native American.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have the
mm-hmm.
the fringe on it, doesn't have the chant in it.
Yeah.
Do you think somebody just picking that up cold would know it was comes from a tradition?
Maybe not. And I think that'd be good, because I think that Native American writing or poetry, you know, as it's seen in English translation, is too easily labeled. You know, you find the adjectives, beauty and simplicity. And it is very simply written, but the chants and the songs, you know, from each tribe or each background like that, probably would have much more to them than the way they look in English, you know. And so I think that this has caused a stereotyped view of what Indian writing is supposed to be about. One of my friends, the editor and poet, who's a Yuki Indian from Round Valley Reservation in Northern California, Bill Wandeson. Bill Wandeson calls a lot of the writing where people are striving to be Indian, you know, to show Indian stuff, either Indians or non-Indians. He refers to that kind of writing as drums and feathers. And he's right, you know, where you make a constant effort to, or conscious effort, you know, to say, well, my heart beats like the drum of the earth, you know, or my heart shall soar like an eagle. Those are stereotypes, you know, and they're old. You know, they've been used time after time. You know, it's almost right out of Longfellow.
Yeah, I was thinking when I said fringes and...
Mm-hmm. Fringes is a good word.
Fringes and war hoops is what came to my mind.
Well, it's perfect, yeah. Fringes and war hoops. I'll have to steal that. But that's a variation of what Wandeson would refer to as drums and feathers. Yeah, fringes and war hoops, yeah.
I heard you say in the class that that you are conscious, very conscious of living in 1979,
but there are voices in the past, and mm-hmm. and that you hear them. What do those voices tell you?
Well, like for instance, I used the example of in my family, we have stories that have been passed down about the Trail of Tears, you know, in regard to Cherokees. You know, when the Cherokees were forced, you know, to emigrate, you know, from the east, you know, to Indian territory, and we have the stories about what certain family members were doing during that time. And
this was
it was in 1838. Yeah, the winter of 1838-1839. Although many Cherokees had moved a little earlier than that, but the mass of the tribe, the bulk of the tribe, was moved.
Were,
you know,
were
during
forced
that winter.
To move.
Yeah, they were rounded up and sent to west, you know, and it was a very painful period of you know of Indian history.
Give
and
us the hard facts about how many went
okay,
and how many left.
Yeah, it started in May of 1838, the roundup, and General Winfield Scott. Came in with 7,000 federal troops and Georgia volunteers and rounded up the Cherokee Nation within a month in four states, Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, and North Carolina. And they concentrated people in camps, which General Winfield Scott called, you know, officially concentration camps. And they were kept there. Great numbers of people died because of the containment and because of the bad food and bad weather. You know, it was extremely hot, dry, no rain.
And
they were unprepared for it. They were having to eat the kinds of food that they weren't used to, you know, when they were in confinement. A lot of people died, so they were weakened at the time when the march began in early October. And then over the period of that, from early October through March of the next year, March of 1839, over 4,000 people died out of 14,000. And so we refer to that as, it's in history books, it's called the Trail of Tears. And we refer to it as Nunada Otsunyi, the road where the people cried. And you can see how Trail of Tears would come out of that, you know, that translation. But it's something, it's a key incident in Cherokee history, and really in all Indian history. It's something that, you know, that the stories are there, and I hear it. I've written about it, and I think sometimes I can hear things out of the past about it. I mean, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe crazy, you know. But I have had real feelings sometimes. Maybe that's what being a writer is when you feel like, you know, that the past is only just, well, there's no real difference in, you know, yesterday and today and tomorrow. It's just, you know, it's the people are still here. We just don't see them. They're in different dimensions, perhaps. And sometimes, you know, because of the intensity of what they lived, what they felt, it may touch us right now. You never know. I think that there's a closeness there.
Gary Hobson has put together an anthology of contemporary Native American literature entitled The Remembered Earth, which, by the way, contains works by two Alaskan natives, Lucia Beta of Fort Yukon, and Mary Tallmountain, who was born in Nulato. In another program, we'll discuss problems Native Americans have in common in writing, translating, and telling their stories. For Chinook Profiles, I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller. Gary Hobson is a Native American writer. He's part Cherokee and part Chickasaw from the border country between Arkansas and Oklahoma. In a previous program, he told us that he doesn't mind the label Native American attached to his work. He's proud of his heritage and cannot separate it from his writing. But that is not to say that he's bound by tradition. The style and message of his poems and essays is very contemporary. He has also put together an anthology of contemporary Native American literature, but even there, the tie with tradition is reflected in the title, The Remembered Earth. Here is the second part of our conversation.
You had said that remembering was an important part of your writing, and that it's key to how you feel about writing and perhaps about what you write about.
I think so. It's certainly with me. It's the things I write about in everyday life has antecedents that go way back. You know, in terms of my own culture, in terms of things that happened long before us, even if a person were not going to be a writer, I think the idea of what memories can do for you and the way they can enrich your life, the way you cherish them and are able to recall them and to practice the idea of making memory a very strong conscious thing can be a creative act, and it can make, as you go through your life, give you so much more meaning. You know, the more things you can remember, the richer you are, whether you put it on paper or whether you just be silent with it. And to me, remembering is, like I say in the book, remembering is all. That's a variation of Shakespeare when he's talking about in King Lear, he's ripeness is all, you know, and Melville uses that too in Moby Dick, you know, relating to Shakespeare. In that sense, I'm saying basically the same thing, because ripeness meaning, you know, that the aging process and when you ripen and become a person who's finally aware, you know, and knows things and wise, and then you've arrived in a sense, and ripeness is all. Well, okay, part of that would be the process of remembering. Remembering is all. So I'm just modifying Shakespeare and Melville to an extent.
And that brings me to a question about how do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
Remembering here. Especially, it's an oral tradition with the native stories, songs.
Mm-hmm.
It's not written down, or hasn't been until fairly recently.
Recently, generally. Mm-hmm.
Is that something that comes, that kind of remembering? I wonder if that comes easier to people that don't have the written words, don't have books, they can go go to the shelf and pull out and say, oh yeah, I remember that because it's written down.
Yeah, it might, because if people are not, if they are in an oral tradition, you know, where they're used to hearing the stories, you know, then they're in the habit of having to memorize or to remember. And so it might be a little easier than the people who would, like class or cultures of people where there's a lot of distractions, you know, where you would say, well, I don't have to remember that because it's in a book, you know. And the oral tradition, remembering is a key word there too. You know, you remember the stories and pass them on. Scott Momaday talks about in The Man Made of Words that the oral tradition is so precious to Native peoples because it's so tangible. I'm so fragile. In other words, it's always in danger, you know, just one generation of being wiped out completely. You get rid of one generation of people who are supposed to pass the stories on from the grandparents to the children, and if they're gone, then things are lost, you know. And that's the reason why it's so dear, you know, why it's cherished. You know, you have you grew up with the stories, you know, and you pass them on, you continue them, even if you write them down, you know. That's, you know, that's passing it on too, you know.
And that presents a dilemma, though, for mm-hmm. some people up here. That, and I think you can cite cases
mm-hmm.
where one of the problems that came out to be a problem is that Native writers sometimes hesitate to write mm-hmm. things down because it's giving away secrets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then again, you have to preserve it.
Mm-hmm. Now that's a real dilemma, you know, in a sense, you know, I like to refer to people as being, you know, people within our own cultures as being preservers and destroyers, I guess. And most people, non-Indian as well as Indian, in regard to Indian materials, have the, you know, their whole intention is to be preservers, you know. I can think of very few, you know, who've ever really set out to be destroyers, you know, Indians as well as non-Indians. I know some in both cultures, you know, who've been destroyers. I know many who've been preservers in both cultures. But it is a real problem, I know, in contemporary things. I used the example yesterday, like Pueblo people in New Mexico. The different Pueblos finally got used to the idea of people making their jewelry and selling that, and pottery and blankets and things of that sort. Now, in the last 20 years or so, some of their own people are writing, and there was a tendency to feel that people were giving away secrets, that they were destroying, you know, they were letting things break, you know, or allowing things to get lost, giving it out to the public.
And violating
trust
of the
trust.
People.
Yeah, uh-huh. But I think now they've realized, and some people suffered for it, some writers. A very good friend of mine, Simon Ortiz, one of the better writers, Native American or otherwise, in the United States today, has suffered that way. But he's a strong man, and he proved, you know, over the years that he's not a defiler, you know, he's not a destroyer, that in essence he's a preserver. And now he's cherished by the Yakima people. They realize that what he tells in his stories and in his poems are, you know, the stories that Yakima people know, but he tells them in such a way that it doesn't defile, you know, it doesn't, mm-hmm. That Yakima people have nothing to, you know, to worry about. That. And in my own case, I know certain things, like the stories can be told as far as we're concerned, but I know things like in certain traditions that I'm not supposed to tell, and I won't, because it's, you know, it has religious connotations. And I've always felt that it's extreme impoliteness, you know, to put your religion on someone else, you know. And so I don't discuss those things, you know.
Even though it might help people like me understand you better and understand what you say better, don't you think? I'm wondering if the more people know about it, the more easily they can understand some of the thought process and
okay,
problems.
That, again, is part of the dilemma. But I think that, you know, there are things that, you know, maybe if it's in danger of violating, you know, then, you know, it has to be left that way. For instance, like in Vatican ritual, you know, there are things that I'm not Catholic and never had any exposure to Catholicism, but if I were to go to Rome today, I could not be asked to, you know, just to go in and see the Pope or to hear certain, have them explain what they mean by chants and ceremonies and things like that. They would say, well, stick around for a little while, let's see if you're sincere and learn some things and see where your head's at, you know, and then they may begin to tell me. But I would have to respect that, and I do, you know, and probably would never maybe learn it anyway. You know, they might never ever tell it to me, you know. But again, I think there's a point where, in terms of religion, you know, that it's the holiness is involved in the ceremony, you know, and in the words that are connected with the ceremony. And if it's in danger, you know, of telling everybody that, if that endangers it, well, you know, for those people, you know, don't violate it, leave it alone, you know, that way.
But there are other things that you do want told and that need to be told.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that presents a problem, particularly in the Athabascan Indian culture and some of the Eskimo, is not good to stand up and talk about yourself.
That's
or
right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or tell a story or to appear to stand out.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And when
yeah.
that, but yet again, there's the need to have the stories told and somebody has to speak.
Yeah, and someone maybe from the people who tells it in such a way that it is really for the people, you know, and as well as for themselves. To say that, okay, here we are represented by one of our people doing this, this person of this particular tribe saying it. I can see that, a lot of, I feel very embarrassed sometimes when I'm, when I'm beginning to speak, and about things, I think about that too. I said, well, who am I to speak mm-hmm. for Cherokees, you know, for many different reasons, you know. But again, you know, there's me too, you know, there's my part, you know. And it goes back to the first part of that question, you know, a Native American writer or another kind of writer. It's hard to divorce it, you know.
Yeah. It brings me to kind of a technical question about language. Another mm-hmm. problem that occurs rather frequently here is that you have writers and speakers, storytellers mm-hmm. that are bilingual mm-hmm. and they want to tell the story, express the song, so that it makes sense in English, but often mm-hmm. often it doesn't. I wonder if you get mm-hmm. into that kind of trouble where your thoughts mm-hmm. or your patterns or your language may be in Cherokee or mm-hmm. For other writers, for other native languages, you get tangled up in having to put it in English.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, there are certain stories that I could maybe, that I think about, you know, I know them in Cherokee and I know them in English too that are about Cherokee, but I cannot, I don't bother telling them sometimes or even thinking about doing it, because I know that what the story depends on is the way of using the language and the whole meaning. Since I can't really convey it in the same way in English, it would almost be meaningless, you know. It's like the joke with the punchline, you know, when it's used in another language, you said, well, what do you mean by this? It's like if you've watched Saturday Night Live and you've seen Dan Aykroyd and who's the other fellow? Oh, Steve Martin, you know, do the thing about the Czech.
Oh, the crazy, brothers. Too
yeah,
wild and
wild
crazy
and
guys.
Crazy guys, you know. And the way they are using all the cliche things, you know, and they'll say things that they think maybe in, you know, as they say it in English, you know, might be really cool, but it just falls flat.
Yeah.
So the same way, if I were using, you know, I can think of certain Indian stories, you know, and I think of the thing of the puns that are used in, you know, that the whole story depends on, and if you tell it in English, it would fall on a deaf ear, you know. And same thing, you know, putting English, I suppose, into Indian, you know, or
like any joke, mm-hmm. it ruins yeah. it to have to go back and explain it
yeah,
all too.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. So not just the funny stories, but also many other stories, you know, ceremonial stories or. or legends or things like that, you know. So it's translation is a, you know, oh yeah, it's a major thing to deal with.
Gary Hobson, writer, editor, poet, and Native American. He teaches in the Native Studies program at the University of New Mexico. For Chinook Profiles, I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.